The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
You'll hear a lecturer talking to students about the ozone layer and CFCs. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 7. Now listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 7.
Today, it is well known that CFCs, or chlorofluorocarbons, can do immense damage to the ozone layer, which protects the Earth from harmful radiation from the sun. However, it was as recently as the mid-1970s when the connection between CFCs and ozone layer destruction was first established. The story starts back in 1957, when James Lovelock invented the electron capture detector. This is a machine that can detect very small amounts of a chemical compound in the atmosphere. Indeed, using the machine, it was Lovelock who was the first person to detect the widespread presence of CFCs in the Earth's atmosphere. In 1973, Lovelock, on a research trip which he'd funded himself, measured the amount of CFCs in the atmosphere in the Arctic and in Antarctica, but unfortunately came to the wrong conclusion that CFCs are not harmful to the environment. Following on from this work, though, in 1974, Sherry Rowland and Mario Molina published the very first scientific paper on the connection between CFCs and ozone depletion. This quickly prompted the world's first ban on the use of CFCs, which was enacted in 1975 by the U.S. state of Oregon. Further bans followed. In 1978, the United States and several European countries banned the use of CFCs in spray cans. CFCs were still allowed to be used, though, for refrigeration and in solvents. It was in the mid-1980s that scientists in Antarctica observed a huge depletion in the ozone layer above them, often called the hole in the ozone layer. This led, in 1987, to the signing of the Montreal Protocol, which called for further reductions in the production and use of CFCs, and then, 2 years later, to a European Union agreement to ban the production of all CFCs by the end of the century.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 8 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 8 to 10.
So why exactly are CFCs so harmful? One of the reasons CFCs were so popular in the production of solvents and refrigeration coolants is that they are unreactive. That is, they don't react easily or at all with other chemical compounds. It's this property, however, that also makes them dangerous. Because they are unreactive, it's very difficult for them to be broken down. This gives them a long lifespan, more than 100 years in some cases, and allows them to rise into the upper levels of the atmosphere, the stratosphere, unchanged. There, ultraviolet radiation from the sun starts to break them down, freeing the chlorine atoms from the CFCs. It's this chlorine that helps destroy the ozone there.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You'll hear a monologue about a guided tour to London.
First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 17. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 11 to...
Hello, can I just have your attention for a minute? Thank you. My name is Mary Golding. Some of you may recognise me. I used to be a lecturer here at the college, but I changed jobs last year and now I work as the student officer. Okay, well, I'm in today to tell you about a guided tour that we've got going to, London. Well, this'll be a good chance for those of you who haven't been to London before to have a look at this beautiful city. I think those of you who come will thoroughly enjoy it. The trip is going to be for 5 days, from the 31st of March, which is a Saturday, to the 4th of April, the following Wednesday. We'll be taking a medium-sized coach, so there'll be 45 places on that. Last time it was a minibus with only 16 places, which proved insufficient for students' needs. According to the London Development Agency, London has over 200 museums, 500 cinema screens, 108 music halls, and 5 symphony orchestras. Needless to say, we can't see it all in one day. Here are some major sites we are going to tackle on the first visit to London. On the first day we're in London, we'll be going on a boat trip up the River Thames and up the London Eye. The Eye is a giant modern Ferris wheel which stands on the south of the river, across from the Houses of Parliament. The boat cruise is included in the cost of the trip, so you won't need to worry about spending extra money. But you have to pay to ride the Eye to gaze out over the vast city. After that, we'll visit the Houses of Parliament. The Houses of Parliament, also known as Westminster Palace, was designed in the Gothic style. One of London's famous landmarks, Big Ben, the clock tower named for its 13-ton bell, is also found here. You can have a free visit up there. I think you all know Westminster Abbey, one of the most visited Christian churches in the world. There is no admission charge for this, but there are lots of souvenir shops around, so you might need some money for those. On the second day, we'll be going to the British Museum. The oldest museum in the world is also the most visited site in London. You have to pay to get in there, but it's not expensive.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 18 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 18 to 20.
Also the most visited site in London. You have to pay to get in there, but it's not expensive. The museum's newly constructed £100 million Great Court, a 2-acre square enclosed by a glass roof, is the largest covered public square in Europe. It is called the Great Court. On the third day, you'll be free to do whatever you like. Personally, I recommend the Natural History Museum. It has over 68 million specimens. Fun exhibits include the Blue Whale exhibit, Rainforest Gallery, Earthquake Experience, and Dinosaur Displays. The Globe Theatre is a place worthy of visiting. The original Globe Theatre, where actors performed William Shakespeare's plays, burned down in 1613. The newly reconstructed Globe, however, copies original drawings of the 16th century's building's details and uses many of the same techniques and materials. Theatregoers can see performances of Shakespeare's plays, such as Romeo and Juliet and Much Ado About Nothing. If you'd like, can you sign up on this form on the student notice board by Friday? It'll be first come, first served.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part three.
Part three.
You'll hear an introduction about canoeing.
First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 24.
Have you imagined paddling around on a river in a small boat? Canoes, which are narrow boats and usually hold one or two people at the most, are particularly well known for being unstable and turning over in the water. But more and more people enjoy this dangerous sport. Today, Cynthia Bocci, an adult education teacher and an addict of canoeing as well, will share her experience of canoeing with us. Cynthia, when did you begin this sport?
Well, I started it 6 or 7 years ago, and soon I got attracted by the exercise. I have to admit that it brings me great fun. It's become part of my life.
So, could you describe how you do it?
At first, I think you need some like-minded friends. The friends who share the same interest with you. It's no fun at all if you canoe alone. Usually we assemble in a parking shelter near the Island Lake Recreation Area. We pull our canoes from inside the vans, lift them from atop the cars and trucks, and attach wheels to help transport them to the shores of the lake beside the boat dock.
What equipment do you need for the sport?
Well, first and foremost, a canoe, of course. The price ranges from £300 to £700, depending on the material they're made from. The more you can pay, the better, really. Personally, I wouldn't look at anything under £500, but that obviously depends on your budget. You also need a hard helmet to protect yourself against rocks when you fall out of the canoe, and believe me, that is very likely to happen. Because of this, it's a must for a beginner to wear a wetsuit. Oh, bathing suits don't work, really. Sometimes a life jacket is a necessity, in case you fall into water and no one else is nearby.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 25 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 25 to 30.
Think it's all worth it?
Absolutely. I just love it. It's exciting, exhilarating, yet it's peaceful and it's calm. You can work as hard as you want to, or you can take it easy. In addition to having fun, canoeing offers a workout without realizing you're working out. Besides being a great exercise, which is good to heart and lungs, you gain strength and mobility. You build strength not only by paddling, but also from lifting and carrying your canoes. You can also exercise your mobility. Frankly, I never had upper body strength until I started canoeing. Now I can pick my canoe up and carry it on my shoulder with no problem. However, it's not just a workout of the upper body, but also a total body workout. If you're doing it correctly, it's a great calorie burner. And more important to me, paddling isn't strictly about exercise. It's as much about the peace and relaxation that comes from being out on the water. I saw it described on a brochure as liquid medicine for the soul, and that is so accurate. It allows you to take a mental break from your ordinary routine. It's a lot of fun, and you meet a lot of great people. We connect on the waterways by responding to email invitations, posting on websites, and club announcements. Also, it's a great way to get an up-close view of nature. You can sneak up on wildlife. I've been right next to ducks, deer, and all kinds of birds. You just get a different view than you can get on land. I especially enjoy camping by canoe. It's like backpacking without having to carry a pack on your back. You can put everything you need in the hatches of the canoe. Have you experienced this kind of camping? Well, whatever you say about this sport, it's never dull. I think on one level it's a serious activity and you can become a real champion, but it's a small group who take it that far. But for most, it's a fantastic sport for anyone who likes adventure.
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part four.
Part four.
You are going to listen to a student, Liz, giving a seminar presentation on advertising. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Listen to the talk and answer questions 31 to 40. Today, Liz is going to give her presentation. Liz?
For my presentation, I looked at the different forms of advertising, especially at how women are portrayed by the media.
So, Liz, tell us what different forms of advertising you looked at.
As you can see from the outline on the screen, I looked at a wide variety of different medias, including billboards, television ads, newspapers, and, of course, the internet. Oh, yes, I almost forgot. I also looked at films.
And what was your main finding?
Well, I've brought some samples in to show everyone, which I hope will make it a little clearer. But first of all, I'd like to take a look at this first advert, which is from, believe it or not, a popular women's magazine. Now, even though this is a women's magazine, as you can see, women are portrayed in what we might call a submissive role. That is to say, they are always the ones doing the housework, going shopping, or caring for the baby. In fact, you may notice that most adverts concerned with household products, such as cleaning materials, as well as food and baby items, are generally directed at women. Another thing you may notice about the women is that they are nearly always very slim and beautiful, even middle-aged women. None of them are ever shown to be poorly dressed or to be overweight.
So, Liz, how are men normally portrayed in these adverts?
Well, if you take a look at the next picture, which is in fact from the same magazine, you will notice that men are seen to be strong, powerful and in charge. They give the image of being in charge, being the ones who make the decisions. And generally, they are dressed either in sports clothes, showing their prowess or fitness, or a business suit, which serves to depict their social status.
You mentioned that you also looked at films. Do these same images apply to the movie industry?
Yes, they do indeed. And again, I have some images to show you. This time, however, I've arranged the pictures so that you can see clearly the different roles that men and women play in the films. Notice, first of all, that it is the man who is in charge. He's the one driving a big, luxurious car and constantly contacting the office on his mobile phone. Now, if we look over here to the woman, we see she is subservient to the man. She's his secretary, in fact. And if we take a look at her office, we see it's shared by other women and open to the public. In contrast, her boss's office, who is the man, of course, has a very large, spacious office all to himself. And if the woman wants to enter, she first has to get his permission. That is to say, she has to first of all knock at the door and wait until he invites her to enter. However, if the man wants to talk to the woman, he simply picks up the phone and requests her attention.
Are there any images where women are not shown to be of a lower social status to men?
No, there aren't. Well, very few, in fact. There are, of course, times when the woman, for example, is playing the part of a scientist with a man as her assistant. Yet even here, she is not in a position to make decisions. Decisions, in fact, are still made by her boss, who, of course, is a man. In other less extreme conditions, such as we can see here, the woman is playing the role of a housewife and mother, while her husband goes out to work to earn the money. In other words, the man is seen to have more control over the situation than the woman, who has to rely upon her husband for her livelihood.
So, how far do you think this reflects real life?
That's hard to say, because generally, women do tend to do more housework and cooking than men. It is generally accepted that women are better able to care for children. But the problem is that we are told through the media that women are not as capable or as strong as men, that women are not as able as men to make important decisions. This, of course, is totally untrue. Many women are at least as capable as men at making decisions, more so in some cases.
Are women ever seen in the media to be superior to men?
Very rarely, in fact. And when they are seen to be better or faster or stronger than men, they are also seen to be a freak. You know, someone with superhuman powers. In other words, they are not seen to be an ordinary person like you or me.
Why do you think that is?
It's probably because if people know it's too ridiculous to be true, then they are not going to believe it. This way, it won't harm men's image.
So, what's the internet like?
In fact, I think the internet is probably the worst of all the media. I don't know why exactly, but I think it's probably because there is little or no control over the internet. Instead, the internet is seen as a type of no man's land, if you like. That is to say, it's not actually owned by one person or one company. Therefore, people are free to put whatever information on the internet they want.
So, would you say that information on the internet should be censored?
I think there should be some control over the internet, because some of the images are dangerous.
Dangerous?
Yes, indeed. For adults, I guess it's not such a big problem, because mature people are able to decide for themselves what to believe and what not to believe. But children are a different matter. They accept information that is presented to them without questioning that information, or considering the consequences of believing it. In other words, children believe what they see or what they are told.
And how do other people feel about information on the internet?
Actually, I carried out a survey to find out other people's opinions. As you can see from this chart, the majority of people over the age of 28 were in favour of restricting the information. It was only people under the age of 20 who really thought that information shouldn't be censored. In fact, only about 8% said that information on the internet should be restricted in some way.
Well, thank you, Liz. That was a very interesting topic. And I'm sure that if any of you have any questions, Liz would be more than happy to answer them.
That is the end of part 4.
You now have half a minute to check.